My guest in this episode, Jeff Staple. If you know him, he does not need any introduction. If you haven't heard of Jeff yet, he's a designer who runs different businesses. He is an influential figure in the streetwear industry for over 25 years. Today, he still works with the smartest and most creative minds in the industry. I had the chance to talk to him about how his career started and how it developed over the last 2.5 decades. Hey, Jeff. Great to have you here. Thanks a lot. Thanks a lot for your time.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me on.
You've done so much in your life already, and it's really hard to introduce you and to make everyone aware of who you are if people don't know you already. But is it kind of fair to introduce yourself as a designer who built several different kind of businesses?
Yeah. I mean, I still have a hard time describing what I do as well to people. And I think it depends on who I'm talking to, whether I want the conversation to be very short and cut off, or if I'm actually interested in telling them what I do. So I'll go with the lengthier one for you, since we're going to engage in a good dialogue here. I'm a designer by trade, I would say. And I did start a couple of different businesses. Said very simply, I started a clothing line, a creative agency, and a retail store. And then just based off of the successes, relative successes of those businesses, I'm sort of seen as a ambassador, if you will, or a thought leader in that niche field. And I guess we could get into what that niche is. Because I think probably, you know, to some people, when you say you do a clothing line, they think like, oh, can I buy it at the Gap or Abercrombie or something like that, or Walmart? Like, and it's very different than that, right? I guess that's in a nutshell what I do, but there's levels. There's many layers and levels to it.
But you started as a designer, so that's the official career that you took. You went to a college, took design studies there. When did you know that you want to be a designer, and what kind of designer? Because designer is such a broad thing. Was it more in your heart that you thought initially, I want to be a graphic designer, I want to do those amazing things, because the internet was not yet born. So that was kind of in the early 90s, mid-90s, right, when you became a designer?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was a very late bloomer, meaning I did not know what I wanted to do until I was well into my second to third year in college. I'm Chinese by ethnicity. My parents are born in China and Hong Kong. They immigrated to the United States to have me and have me be, you know, the first ever Klan member that has a U.S. passport, that graduated a U.S. high school, that will go to a U.S. college, that will be a doctor or a lawyer in the United States. That's like the immigrant success story, right? So I was sort of like just expected to live that track. And of course, it didn't work out that way simply because I'm not that book smart. You know, I don't like studying. I don't really like school. I don't love rules. You know, I like breaking rules. I don't like following rules. But with that being said, you know, there's still a very deep kind of like, I think this is the mentality of a son of an immigrant, and the only son of an immigrant also, you know, the only child son too, is that like there's still this like beholden kind of like a dedication that I still have to make my parents happy, like in some way. So I wasn't like, F you parents, I'm going to go run away and do my own thing and start a punk rock band. Like I knew I wasn't going to be a doctor or lawyer, and I knew I wasn't going to go to an Ivy League school, but I also was trying to make them happy at the same time, you know? And so what happens then is you're just caught in this middle no man's land where you're neither a punk rock kid, nor are you a doctor. You're just sort of like this nomad. And that's what I did. You know, I graduated high school. I decided I wanted to go to New York University. I had a love of creative writing, like just writing for fun. But I knew that there was no real career choice in that. So I majored in journalism as sort of like a way that one could potentially make a living and write at the same time. So I took journalism at NYU. And so now I'm in my first and second year at New York University, and still at that point in my life where I'm a young adult, you know, I'm 20 years old, I have no inkling or dream that I could be a creative of any standpoint. Like being a designer was fully outside of my scope of reality. There was no version of my future where I was going to be a designer. Trust me when I say that. Like, I didn't even really understand. Like, I was a big sneakerhead, meaning, like, you know, I loved footwear and sneakers. I collected sneakers. But I didn't understand that sneakers were, like, designed by someone. There was, like, a concept. There was, like, a sampling. Like, I thought shoes just, like, got punched out of a machine in China. You know, like, a factory just squeezed out sneakers. I didn't understand any of it. I'll tell you what happened as a sidetrack was that all throughout my life since I was 13 years old, I've had to work. So, you know, my family doesn't come from any sort of means or wealth. So if I wanted any sort of spending money, I had to earn it myself. And so from the age of 13, I worked tons of random jobs. Like I delivered pizzas in my car. I cleaned tables, bussed tables at a Chinese restaurant. I swept up hair at a hair salon. I developed film in a one-hour film lab when those used to exist. You remember the VHS video stores where you rent videotapes?
Of course.
Someone has to rewind all the videos. I did that job. Like, I rewound all the videos in a video store. So just
because
anything
people never do
fun.
That at home.
People never do it, and they get charged a dollar. And I get that dollar. So I'm the one who gets the dollar. Yeah, so I did all these random jobs and tons of them. I rotated fruit at a grocery store, you know. Of course, I worked in a sneaker store. I worked at a clothing store. But in college, too, I had to continue to work. And as fate would have it, I got a job at a graphic design studio when I was at New York University. And, you know, back then, the minimum wage was like literally $5 an hour back then. And so I remember when you were looking for a job, if a job paid $5.25, you're going for that job. If you found another job that paid $5.50, you're going for that job. Like, it's just to make that extra quarter, you know? Like, that's what life was all about. And I found this graphic design data entry position where you answer the phone calls, you type in the data, and you send it to the right person. And it was like, I think it was like $12 an hour. And it was like, $12 an hour, that's like, I'm rich. Like, that's amazing. So I applied for that job. It was in Soho, New York City, and I got the job. And that was the first time that I had seen people with a job called a designer, a graphic designer. I had no idea that, like, people could just push photos around in Photoshop all day and get paid to do that, you know? And I was like, man, this is so cool. And the other thing that was really interesting was they didn't want me to use your standard apps that I knew, like Microsoft Word, Excel, you know, PowerPoint. They didn't want me to use those. They wanted me to use Illustrator, Photoshop, and this program back then called Quark Express, which is now gone. For those of you who know
the
Quark
old
Express,
ones, the old ones remind that.
Yeah.
Quark Express. That was
if you
so
know
expensive.
Quark, you're aging yourself. You were definitely born in the 70s if you know Quark. It's now Adobe InDesign, basically. But they wanted me to do all my data entry into those programs, so they had to teach it to me. And so I was learning these great apps. And this was the first time that I was like, you know, to answer your question in a very long-winded way, this was the first time where I was like, huh, I wonder if there's like a career in this for me. That was the first time. But it was late, you know, really late in my life.
I should have known that 20 years before, almost 30 years before, because I always wanted to be a designer, but I thought I need to be able to paint well. So yeah. I was told, if you want to be a designer, you need to be able to paint, but I had no clue about painting, so I became more kind of a project manager, but maybe I shouldn't have given up like this too quickly. But basically, so you had no, I don't know, graphic design idols or people that you always wanted to be like that. So that is super interesting that you basically just sat there, used Photoshop to enter some kind of data.
Yeah, I mean, I was into... There was artful things that I was into. I wasn't completely like lacking in art. My entryway into art was really through comic books. So I was like a big comic guy. So I loved Marvel, DC, you know, Wolverine, X-Men, Spider-Man, things like that. And what I would do is I would try to redraw the characters myself. Like I would try to do my version of an X-Men, you know. And so there was creativity, and I had sketchbooks and things. But I never thought it could be a career. And in fact, the funny story is when I transferred, you know, from NYU to then a proper art school, which is I went to Parsons School of Design after that, you know, I wanted to take design classes at NYU because I was going there already And I thought, let's give this a go. Let me dabble in some design classes. NYU at the time didn't offer any design classes whatsoever. So then I was thinking, like, man, I'm paying like $35,000 a year tuition, and like I'm getting into crazy student debt, and I can't even take a class that I want to take. And, you know, my boss at the graphic design studio, he's like, you know, just 10 blocks north of NYU is one of the best design schools in the world, Parsons. You should check it out. So I went over there and I checked it out, and I was like, it just felt right. It just hit me in my gut when I walked onto the school campus. I was like, oh my God, this is what I want. There was nothing inspiring at NYU for me. And so so when I applied to Parsons, the funny story is I actually used my childhood sketchbooks of comic books to get in. That was the only artful thing I had to show for my interview. And so I'm showing my guidance counselor, the admissions counselor, like sketches from when I was 8 to 13 years old. And she was just like, really? This is what you brought? Like a manila envelope of your child sketches? I was like, that's all I have. But it got me in.
And how did she react? So actually they took you just because of the money, or they took you because she saw some talent in you?
Yo, this is a very funny story. So we do the interview, and she's like, you know what? Let me take you on a tour. So we get out of her office, and she takes me on a tour of the campus, and she shows me some freshman year student work. She's showing me all this amazing work. And I think to your point, she's showing me kids who are like born phenoms. Like they're amazing painters and artists from birth, right? And she shows me that to tell me that, like, see, Jeff, you're obviously not there. Like she's showing me like who I'll be up against right away. And I'm like, oh, okay, this is a different level. But then, so we leave. She's like, you know, yeah, I don't think it's going to work out. And she leaves, right? I leave. Back then, really weird side story. I used to skate. I used to rollerblade, like, because I played ice hockey at NYU. And, you know, in the summers, I would rollerblade to train for ice hockey. And so I was a rollerblader. And this particular year in the 90s was like the pinnacle of rollerblading, where like it was the hottest sport for like 2 years. There was like this span where you couldn't buy a pair of rollerblades anywhere in the city. It was like just crazy demand. And I skated to the interview, and I brought my skates into the interview at Parsons. And then so I remember going back to work at the graphic design studio after my terrible interview, and my boss picks up the phone, and he's like, Jeff, it's the admissions counselor from Parsons. She wants to talk to you. I was like, oh, okay. So I pick up the phone, and she's like, hey, I noticed that when you did the interview with me that you skated to the interview and you left in skates. I was like, yeah. She's like, do you offer lessons to people in how to skate? Like, do you teach people how to skate? And I was like, yeah, I do. I actually did. I did sort of like help people learn how to skate. And so I was like, yeah, I could teach you. And she's like, cool. She's like, how about like 10 p.m. tonight? I was like, okay. So we made a date to teach her how to skate at 10 p.m. And then that kicked off like a relationship where we ended up like actually dating for like 6 months. And that's how I got into Parsons, is because I dated the admissions counselor. True story.
You see, you don't need to be a perfect designer to get in there already. You just need to have the right skills somewhere else.
I guess you could say I slept my way through art school.
No, you roller skated into art school.
That was the bait. But yeah. It was pretty interesting. I think it's been long enough where I don't think anyone will get in trouble at this point. It's well past the statute of limitation on, like, you know, it was definitely probably gray in terms of legalities of what we were doing.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely.
But
so this brought you somehow into the...
This is a precursor to my whole career, that lots of points in my career, someone said, you can't come in here. You can't come in. But I figured out like another way in. And that was going to be like a running theme throughout my career.
So you always took the back door and not the main entrance.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's quite interesting. That brought you somehow into the design. But when did you realize you have some kind of an entrepreneurial gene in yourself? So probably your family didn't have that. But you started somehow then screen printing your first t-shirts while you were still studying. Was that already kind of the mindset of this could be a business, or was this just I do 5 t-shirts for myself?
Yeah, no, it was the latter. It was definitely no entrepreneurial spirit whatsoever. No dreams of owning a company. It was, I was silk screening t-shirts. And I wanted to give them to my friends. You know, I was taking a silk screen class that taught you how to silk screen on paper to make posters out of. And, you know, living in Manhattan, you never go into other people's like homes. Like there's no like home parties. Every kid lives in a studio that's shared with like 3 other people. There's no art wall where like you're displaying art, you know, and like my friends will come over and look at my art. No. So I was like thinking, if I want to make art, instead of putting it on paper, I'd rather put it on a t-shirt, because I think it's such a much more powerful medium. You know, kids are taking the subway, the train, the bus, they're walking around. There's probably easily 10,000 people a day that are looking at what's on this piece of real estate, you know? And so I was like, that's a much better billboard than a piece of artwork that's hanging on a wall, you know, that maybe 5 people a year will get to see. And so I remember I told my instructor in my silk screen class, like, I'm going to start printing on t-shirts if that's cool. And she was like, no, you can't do that. This is only for posters. You can't print on t-shirts. I was like, what difference does it make? It's not a paper, it's a shirt, and I'm doing the same thing. What difference is it? She's like, no, you just can't do that. So that was very frustrating to me. So me and one other friend, we decided to figure out a way to break into the silkscreen lab at night. We would leave the windows unlocked during the day, and then at night, we would literally break in, crawl in through the windows, throw t-shirts in through the window, and then in the middle of the night, we would be printing t-shirts all night long. And we did that night after night after night. It was the time of our lives, essentially creating our own little sweatshop at school. And the purpose of me doing that was literally, to answer your question, just to give my friends these t-shirts. That was it. So I would make up to maybe 20, and then I would give them to my 20 friends. And then sometimes on campus, I would see one of my friends wearing the t-shirt, and it would be like the highlight of my week. And that was the only purpose of doing it. There was really no dream of having a fashion brand or a business at that point. It was merely a form of communication for me.
Yeah, and I think that has changed to today. So now there are so many ways to print your t-shirts, and there are thousands of websites where you can just get t-shirts printed, and everyone is kind of doing it and hoping to become famous. But your way was a total different motivation back then. And then March 7th, 1997 came along. So was that a turning point in your life? And then
massive. Yes, March 7th, 1997. That was my birthday. I had just dropped my girlfriend at the time off to get her hair done, and you know, which takes 3 hours. So I said, I'm going to walk around Soho for 3 hours and kill some time. Dropped her off and walked up Lafayette Street in Soho. Lafayette and Houston is like a very, you know, if you've ever visited New York, it's a very classic intersection of Soho. And there was a shop there of this old streetwear brand called 555 Soul, which was one of sort of like the grandfather of streetwear brands. And they had a store, and they sold other brands. And I walked into the shop wearing one of the t-shirts that I had printed at school, mind you, by breaking in again. And the shop manager was like, hey, that's a cool t-shirt. Where'd you get that? I said, oh, I made it. He's like, wow, cool. He's like, if you want to make a dozen, we'll put them in the shop. I was like, what? Like a boutique in Soho like wants to carry 12 of my shirts? And that was really the first time that somebody wanted to transact and do business with me. It was like my first order, a 12-shirt order. And, you know, I had to break back into school to make those 12 shirts, you know. And I delivered them, and they sold out very quickly. Like within a week, they sold out. And so he ordered another 20, he doubled the order to 24. And another shop across town in Soho, a very legendary store that still is in existence today. It's in Los Angeles now. It's called Union. They ordered also 12, 24, 36, you know, it kept selling out. And so this whole time I'm still breaking into school, making these shirts. Like now, like I'm carrying like 70 shirts into school and like printing them all night long. It was crazy. And so now it was like, it's interesting. I think, you know, you asked me about my business mindset at that time. I still was like playing catch up in my head. Like, this wasn't a business yet. This was just something weird happening. Like, these two stores, they're two legendary street fashion stores, are like ordering a lot. And it's like, I'm still a full-time student in school. I still have also two other part-time jobs. So it's just like something fun that happens to be making a little bit of bread. And that's all it was. And then I remember a couple of months later, definitely within the year, somebody calls me from Japan at night at my home landline number. So like I had a home phone, calls me on my home phone. He's like, oh, I got your number from Union. I visited New York recently and I bought a shirt and I wanted to know if you can ship some to Japan. I was like, whoa, that, Tokyo, Japan. Wow. Okay. Yeah. Which, how many do you want? Which shirt do you want? He's like, oh, I want 1,000 shirts. So it went from like, yeah, 12, 24, 36 to 1,000. And mind you, I'm still breaking into school. So like, there's no way I can now break into school with like 1,500 shirts to print myself. So now it was like a smack in the face reality of like, okay, Jeff, there's a business here if you want it. If you don't, you can hang up the phone, say no thank you, and just go back to being a full-time student, or there is an opportunity here. And I decided that this was too much fun, too awesome. It was the height of sort of like New York City hip-hop culture in the mid-90s and fashion and streetwear. It was the birth of streetwear. And I decided to quit school, quit art school. As you can imagine, my parents, who had dreams of me becoming a lawyer, were very, very happy that their son is like left NYU, dropped out of NYU, enrolled into art school, and then now is dropping out of art school to pursue a career in making t-shirts. You can imagine like these sort of like Chinese immigrant parents like just not understanding at all, and they didn't. We had a very sort of rough relationship going forward for the next few years. But I pursued my dream of, you know, I left Parsons. I decided to pursue this brand thing. And that was the beginning, and it started on my birthday, March 7th, 1997.
Yeah, and by accident, and not even planned, so you ended up being in two of the coolest stores back then. So probably a few hundred meters away was the Supreme store back then, and there was still Stussy, but Union was just right somewhere in there around 98. I was the first time in New York, and I've been in Union, so I could have bought your t-shirt back then already, probably.
Did you ever go in the original Stussy store on like Mercer before they moved to Wooster? Did you ever go to that store? It was across from the Mercer Hotel at one point. Like it's where Mew Mew is now.
I always remember this blue huge flag hanging outside.
Yeah.
With the holes in it when the wind was going too heavy that the flag is not tearing apart this flagpole.
Yes, and
that will always stay in my head forever because I've never seen those huge flags in front of a store, and there was this Stussy sign, and I just totally loved it because I'm from Germany, and we always, of course, wanted to have the cool stuff that was available in the US, and there was no internet and nothing where you could just order it, so it was really hard to get those brands and those things over to Europe.
Right.
So that was like heaven for a, I don't know, I was 20, 21, 23, around that age when I came there first. So by accident, you somehow had the best stores. And I think this was the foundation for you to build anything on top of it. Just out of curiosity, do you still have contact to the person who bought your first t-shirts?
No, I really wish I did. I know their name and everything, but like, I don't know them. I wish I had kept in touch, but I don't think he's the type of person that like is social media savvy and he has an Instagram. Like I've looked for him and I can't find him. And in this day and age, if you can't find somebody online, it's probably because they don't want to be found.
Exactly. But with Union, so they're super successful till today. And I think this is an art form, even 25 years later, being still successful in this business. So did you call your brand back then already Staple? And how did you come up with a pigeon as a logo kind of thing?
Yeah, the brand was called Staple right away because, you know, when that guy, his name is Deflon, by the way, when Deflon placed that 12-shirt order, he's like, I need a name of a brand to put on the purchase order. you know, and like you need a brand name to put on the label too. You can't just have it say Hanes or Gildan or something like that, you know. So I went back and I was like, oh man, I need a brand name now. And I came up with the word staple because, you know, I was really inspired by hip hop culture and music at the time. But if you were a fan of hip hop music and you wanted to wear hip hop fashion, that meant wearing brands that were like really, really gaudy and loud, like FUBU and Sean John and Pelly Pelly and Carl Kanai, like these triple extra large, huge oversized gear with huge logos all over, you know. And it was, that was, if you liked hip hop, that's how you had to dress. Baggy pants, baggy shirt, oversized logos. But as you were saying, because this was the birth of street culture, which was sort of a mix of skate culture, punk rock culture, and hip hop culture, there was kids that like liked hip hop, you know, loved hip hop culture, but liked wearing skinny jeans and better fitting shirts and maybe even some tailored clothing and like not necessarily basketball shoes. They might wear like penny loafers or something, or boat shoes. Like there was like this whole mixing of fashion happening. And so I was like, I wanted to be more about inspired by hip hop culture, but really more about the raw essential elements that you can't live without, not the glitz and glamour and the gaudiness of it, but the essential of it. And so instead of calling my brand, like all the other brands were like, you know, rap wear or woo wear or like, you know, hip hop, triple XL, whatever. I was like, I'm going to call it staple, like the thing that you can't live without, the raw essential element that you can't live without. And I just called it staple, you know. And my name is technically not Jeff Staple. That's not my government name. It was actually Deflon, the manager of that 555 Soul store. I called it staple. He's like, cool, that's a great name. And I remember too, my first logo that I had in my shirt was, you know, when you go to a Chinese restaurant and they have the chopstick package. You know, like I happen to have like, you know, like you get like your utensils and like your chopsticks. And on the side, there's like little instructions on how to use chopsticks. You know, I took that illustration of how to hold chopsticks and I removed the rice and I put the staple logo in the chopstick.
Into it.
And it was kind of like a reference to me being Chinese. It was a reference to the fact that rice is a staple food of people, you know. And so there was like a little double entendre thing. So that was my logo back then. And I remember that when I dropped off the shirts and I left, Deflon was like, all right, thanks, Jeff Staple. I'm like, whoa. I'm not Jeff Staple. Staple's the brand name. I'm Jeff Ng. They're like, and he was like, nah, you're Jeff Staple. I'm like, please don't call me that. Like, I didn't, there was a couple of like, I think Mark Echo was probably like, there was a brand called Echo, which was really big in that time. And Mark Echo was like a big figurehead. But I didn't want to look like I was trying to be like this guy that had a brand name as his last name, like Tommy Hilfiger or Ralph Lauren. Like, I didn't want to do that. But he called me Jeff Staple. And it's unfortunately, it just stuck. And no one would call me by anything else besides Jeff Staple. So I became Jeff Staple.
But interesting. So I really wondered how that came along. So no. No, I know.
Yeah. And then you asked me about the pigeon, which is this logo here.
Yes.
The pigeon came about a few years later. So just to give you some time frame, this was like 1997, 1998 when I first sold this. The pigeon didn't come into play until about 2003. So it came like 5 years later.
Yeah, but I think it's smart. It's just so New York, and you see it everywhere. You basically see it in every big city, and no one had that logo. So if you look at it, so it's so simple, but somehow genius as well. Although everyone would say pigeon is not very sympathetic, but
it didn't seem genius back then. Trust me. Like, you know, I was a fan of brands that had animals as their logo. As I mentioned, you know, Polo Horse, Mark Echo had the rhino. You know, Lacoste the alligator. I loved brands that had animals. So like I wanted an animal. And when I decided to adopt a pigeon, most people were like, that's disgusting. Like pigeons are gross rats with wings. They carry diseases. Yeah. You know, why would you want that? That's not an aspirational animal. And I was like, no, I think it is. I think it really represents a New Yorker, you know, and I would soon come to find out that it not only represented just a New Yorker, but it represented everyone who who's just trying to make it in this, in especially in an urban environment. You know, like if you're living in a city, if you're young and you're people hate on you and people doubt you and you are just trying to survive every day, that is exactly what a pigeon has to do every day, is like figure out how to survive in a city that no one wants them in. And that's what I felt like I was living every day. You know, my parents were against what I was doing. My girlfriend was against what I was doing. I dropped out of school, so my teachers were trying to stop me from silk screening. Like, everyone was just like, no, 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 no. And I was like, but this feels so right. So I just want to keep doing it, you know? And that's kind of like that pigeon mentality of never giving up.
Yeah, and I think that's still true till today. So if you want to do something new, of course, people are usually opposite and haven't seen it before and don't trust it. And what people don't know, they rather dislike and don't want you to follow that path. And maybe that's a good learning always, just to trust the gut feeling and believe in yourself and say, you know, I see a chance in there. And an order of 1,000 t-shirts is not that bad. So I think from there, you got additional stores, more people ordering. And was it inevitable that you just started your own store as well sooner or later? Or how did that come along?
In 5 years later, in 2001, I decided to open up my own store. And, you know, this goes back to you asking me about my business acumen. And I answered by saying I don't really have a business acumen. I don't really have a business plan whatsoever. What happened was we had a little office where we were operating Staple out of now. This is fast forwarding 5 years. And of course, everyone knows that in September of 2001, 9/11 happened, you know, and our office was in downtown New York City. So I was in the shadow of the World Trade Center. We were below Canal in Chinatown. And the morning that 9/11 happened, I immediately went to my office because you know, when you think of the tallest buildings in the world collapsing, you don't understand the geography of how much that, like, is all of downtown New York City gone? Like, it's actually amazing that it just sort of fell inwards of itself instead of, like, falling both to the side, you know? If it fell the other way, it probably would have affected. So I immediately went to my office to see what was going on, and it was covered in, like, this gray dust. But I knew at that point that, like, this was going to change the whole entire neighborhood. Of course, it did. And we tried to stay in there for as long as we could. We got some funding from the city because we were a business that was close to the World Trade. But, like, the power was going out every day. You know, like, medical workers were all over the place. So, like, we couldn't stay there. So we left. As a side note, I still had, as a hobby during this time, I was DJing in nightclubs and lounges throughout the city for fun. Like, I was a old school vinyl, like, 7 crates of record carrying with me DJ at, like, nightclubs in the city. And so post 9/11, I knew that we had to move. And one night I was DJing in the Lower East Side at this club called Swim, S-W-I-M. And, you know, I would finish my gig at, like, 5 a.m. And then this is pre-Uber. So at 5 a.m., if you want to catch a taxi home, you just have to stand on the street with your arm up for like 20 minutes and just wait for a taxi, you know? And I remember it was freezing cold. It was like 20 degrees, and I'm just standing there. I know it's going to take like 15 to 30 minutes for a taxi to come by. It's so weird how it's like pre-Uber. It was like a totally different reality, you know? But I'm standing there waiting, and I noticed this for rent sign across the street. So I walk over, and I look inside the window. And it's this amazing space that goes through the entire city block. And on a whim, I just decided to jot down the number. And I called the number the next day to see how much the rent was. And the rent would end up being 4 times. You know, I was paying like $2,000 a month rent at the time for my office. This space that I was looking at, which was a ground floor store space, was $8,000. So it was like a 4x increase for me in monthly rent. But I knew I wanted an office space that could double as a retail space that people could come in. I also had a lot of friends and peers now in the industry that were making similar streetwear. And we were close, and we always had the same complaints about retail stores not understanding street culture and not being able to tell the customer what this culture was about, not representing us properly, you know. Like, for instance, that big chain Urban Outfitters, like, they tried to buy a bunch of, like, streetwear brands, but, like, if it didn't sell, like, in week one, it would be 50% off, and then, like, we would go in the store, and, like, our shirts would just be, like, on the floor, off the hanger, and, like, no one would bother to pick it up and display it properly. So, like, we were really frustrated with how we were being represented, and so I knew that if I opened the store, I could get all my friends who had streetwear brands, too, to be in the shop as well, and we could represent it properly. So I was like, if I rent this space and half of it is a store, half of it is an office, maybe I can survive as a business. Again, no five-year P&L, no expense plan, nothing. Just pure necessity because of 9/11 and gut, like, this feels good and it's needed. Let's give it a try. And so we opened up a store. We called it Reed Space, R-E-E-D. Reed was named after my high school art teacher in high school, who was really inspirational to me. His name is Michael Reed, so I named the store after him. And we opened for business and had a couple of cool New York brands, a couple of Japanese cool streetwear brands that I met when I would travel out there, and I would literally bring them back in a duffel bag. And then there was a curtain in the middle of the store, and then behind it was the design studio that was making the clothing. And at this time, too, our clothing line was getting so popular that other companies were asking me to design things for them, whether it was like an ad campaign or a logo or an album cover or a flyer, whatever, all these odd jobs. They were asking me to design stuff because they liked what they saw from the clothing line. So I was also accepting this kind of business. So there was kind of like two companies organically happening at once. One was the clothing line and one was the design services, let's call it. And then now I had a retail store. So going all the way back to the beginning of this interview, when you asked me what I do, it's still those same three things. But back then in 2001 in the Lower East Side of New York City, it was all held within this 2,000 square foot space. And now each has expanded into its own tree with its own branches. But it all germinated from that little 2001 Lower East Side space.
Did you ever move the Reed space? Because I've been there in 2007 or 8 or something and remember the store that you could enter from both sides and with all the white chairs in it, etc.
Yeah,
that was the space or was that enough?
That was the same space, dude. Okay. So what happened was the store got so, you know, popular that we extended the store all the way to the other half and I moved the design agency literally upstairs. There was like another space upstairs. So, you know, now you could enter through the entire block. And it was a great space, as you probably know, you know, like there's just a great vibe and a great feeling. It wasn't like, you know, some of you in Europe might know about Colette in Paris. Like Colette was like the glitzier, glossier version of what we were doing. We were much more grassroots and sort of homegrown. But Colette and I started in the same year and we almost closed in the exact same year too. And it's, you know, Sarah from Colette would always come to Reed Space. And I think there was like a sort of yin-yang to what we were doing. But if you've ever been to Colette, we were like the sort of grimier, younger brother of Colette in Paris, you know?
Yeah, it was not that slick and clean. So it was more, it felt more New York.
Yeah.
How I would describe it or feel it somehow. And I think this innovation also came because of a lot of change. So I don't know, maybe it's too hard to say 9/11 was pushing you away from what you've been doing before and opened up new opportunities for you. So, and maybe that's also a little cheap to say, yeah, every crisis also has its chances. And retail back then, that was about experience and seeing things, etc. So we could do a fast forward till today. And I want to cover that as well, what your thoughts are about retail these days. But mm-hmm. Let's spend a moment. You have probably told that story 1,000 times already about 2005 and the pigeon dunk. Sneaker collaborations were not that big in 2005. So
No. It's
hard to imagine these days. Everyone is doing them and there are drops every single week and their sneakers app is sending out push notifications every second day to register for some kind of new drop. So there was no internet, no nothing. So people had to stand in line for something. How did people even know that you're doing a Nike? And how, of course, I can imagine Nike somehow got aware of you. You sold probably some of their stuff in your store. So you met the right people at Nike. And then you just basically said, hey, let's do a shoe. Was it a little bit like that?
A little bit. I mean, we were already designing stuff for Nike behind the scenes, like, you know, kind of like freelance, I would call it, design projects, not collaborations. But we were also designing shoes, too. It's just that the shoes, the word collaboration on shoes hadn't happened yet. So it was like artist designs a shoe. It was somewhere between a proper collaboration and a work for hire freelance job. There wasn't really like a word to define it quite yet. So we had designed like half a dozen or dozen shoes at that point already. So there was already a fully open relationship, dialogue. We were like an approved vendor of Nike. You know, there was a, you know, they could pick up the phone and call me and we could work on a project. So the Dunk is probably next to the Air Force One, probably like the most popular and iconic model of Nike. And, you know, in the past few years, I would argue that the Dunk is even more popular than the Air Force One. So the Dunk was having an anniversary year, and someone from Nike called me. His name is Marcus. He said, you know, would you be interested in designing an anniversary Dunk that's dedicated to the city of New York? And I was like, of course, fuck yes, of course. You know, like, he's like, all right, cool. Come up with some ideas and let me know. And you know, my team genuinely came up with different New York themed ideas on a Dunk. Like, we tried like Statue of Liberty Dunk and the Subway Dunk and the Taxi Dunk and stuff. But as I mentioned to you, you know, we were developing this pigeon logo, which was not necessarily for a shoe and not necessarily purely for New York. But as I mentioned, the DNA of what it means to be a New Yorker was embedded in the pigeon. So we said, what if we made the Dunk look like a pigeon bird? And then, like, you know, we designed like this shoe that had like gray uppers, pink bottom, like the pigeon feet. And then maybe if we actually embroider the pigeon right on the heel, just to make it very evident what this means, this could be interesting. And we loved it. And we showed it to Nike and they didn't get it at all. Like, pigeon? We asked you to design a shoe dedicated to the city of New York and you come back with a pigeon, you know, like sneaker. And the great thing about Nike is that, like, explain to us why. And I explained it and they were like, all right, listen, we chose you as our design partner. If you tell us this means New York, we believe you. We're from Portland, Oregon. We don't understand New York. That's why we even asked you to do this. So if you tell us New Yorkers will get this, fine, we trust you. And so the Pigeon Dunk became born. And what happened was when you can Google this if you want, just type in Pigeon Dunk, Nike Pigeon Dunk, whatever. You'll find tons of videos, documentaries, mini documentary series, like tons of people have covered this. But what happened is when we released this in our store in 2005, there was like this, you know, camp out, lines, riots, NYPD, SWAT team, people arrested, people brought weapons, like people got hurt. Like, it was just crazy. Next day it was on the front page of the New York Post. It was on the evening news. It was like the first time that the whole world saw that people were really fanatical and crazy about sneakers. Before that, it was a very underground, if you know, you know, subculture. After the Pigeon Dunk, every grandma in America was like, did you know kids line up for sneakers? Did you know kids are on eBay paying $300 for sneakers? It's crazy. That was really the shifting point in the culture. And I'm lucky that I was part of it, you know?
So today you would just do a Insta story to announce that. But what did you do back then? Because there was nothing.
Nothing.
Did you do a print ad? Or did you just tell some of your customers? Or
the only,
it was just like...
The only way you could even communicate back then was through chat groups, like, you know, forums, right?
Yeah.
But I wasn't on those forums. I was on them. The kids are just so fanatical, you know, similar to like Comic-Con kids or like, you know, Pokemon guys nowadays. Like, they're just so fanatical. They have people that work at FedEx and UPS that are in on it, like all these like insider trading kind of news, you know. So I assume that these kids knew, because I remember when we got the FedEx package of our shipment of shoes. I remember once FedEx dropped it off and I like opened the box to make sure, okay, these are the Pigeon Dunks. Our phone started ringing immediately. Like, hey, we heard the Pigeon Dunks have arrived. Is it true? Like, I just opened the box 1 second ago. So I really feel like there's like insider information happening. And so right from that day, kids started bringing tents, like camping tents, and pitching them in front of my store 5 days before release day in February, New York City. There was a blizzard. It was like freezing cold blizzard. And kids brought sleeping bags, tents, camping chairs, and they just all lined up in front of the store 5 days in advance to make sure that they get this shoe that I think, you know, represents New York to them.
Yeah, I think 300 were made. Is that correct? Or
yeah, 300 total were made. We had 150. And, you know, eBay was the only way you could resell after that. You know, so we sold the shoe. The retail price on the shoe was $72.50. $72.50. That week on eBay was probably going for 300 to 1,000. And nowadays, today, you couldn't spend less than $30,000 to get a pair of Pigeon Dunks. In fact, just late last year, they were auctioned off at Sotheby's, official Sotheby's auction, for like over $60,000 for a fresh pair. So it's become like this real holy grail of the culture and of the art world now at this point. So it's pretty amazing.
Do you have one or two originally packed and sealed still hidden somewhere in a...
No, I have one that I wore, that I wear, you know, so it's my worn. I don't have one fresh pair of Pigeon Dunks, if you can imagine.
Yeah. And the guy who sold them now for 30,000 made more on them than you did on the 150 sold on your store, on the whole thing. But how much of a burden is this as well at the same time? Because, you know, once we get older, you're always still connected to this launch. And yes, this is great on the one hand, but you still want to be relevant today. So you always need to keep reinventing yourself, etc. And at least I can assume you don't want to be the old guy who talks about the great days when people were camping out in 2005. So how hard was it, or is it still today, to be some kind of relevant still in this industry? You're a legend in this industry, so this was probably one reason. And especially today in 21, and also last year, so tons of Nike Dunks were released, and Nike was hyping up the Dunk again. Yep. And even my son, he's 15, and he knows you because of the story back then. And when I told him we were talking, he's of course, oh, what the heck? So this
that's cool.
Somehow, yeah, it's cool on the one hand, but don't you feel this pressure as well a little bit, just saying, damn, yes, I'm getting older, and all the new shit that is happening these days, am I too old for it? How do I keep relevant and not being the old uncle talking of yesterday?
Yeah, a little bit. I wouldn't even call it pressure. Pressure is probably too hard of a word, but it is an acknowledgement that I cannot and will not rest on my laurels of past successes, you know, and I've done a lot of other things, and it's my job really to educate younger generations on what I have done and what I will continue to do. You know, there is a little bit of a chip on the shoulder of like, some people will say like, oh, all you did was put a pigeon on a shoe and now you're famous for it. But, you know, those people are called haters, and you're always going to have haters. And I don't pay it no mind, because like, if you even just sat down for like 1 minute with any of those haters and had a conversation with them, like, they will realize that, you know, it takes a lot more to do anything for 25 years. Like, even if you had like a laundromat or a hardware store, and if you kept it open for 25 years, that's an accomplishment. But to do something in youth culture, and like the fact that, you know, you mentioned your 15-year-old son knows about me, and a 50-year-old guy knows about what I did too. Like, spanning that generational gap is so challenging, and maintaining your authenticity throughout the whole thing, you know? And you got to remember that, like, Nike wasn't just calling random people to allow them to do shoes. Like, they called me because I did something before that that would justify why they would call me, you know? And it's actually my responsibility and my job to tell those young people, this is what I hustled and did so that Nike did call me, so that when the opportunity came for me to do something, I didn't drop the ball at that point, but I actually maximized it to the greatest ability that I could to then create the legend, the legendary thing, you know? It's kind of like if you look at it like from, I equate it a lot to like music and especially hip hop music. You know, there's a rapper named Nas, N-A-S, who came out with an album called Illmatic, which is often regarded as like a top three album of all time. And whenever Nas is going to do a concert or performance, everyone just wants him to do songs from that album. But he's made like seven albums after that. But like everyone just wants to hear that album. And so there's a gift and a curse there. But it's also such a blessing that he was able to make that album. And it's a blessing that I was able to make the Pigeon Dunk. But now it's our job to A, educate people on how we even got to that point, and B, what we've been doing since then to contribute to the culture further, you know? So it's all on me. I don't feel any pressure from like outside people or the haters. It's just, and it's not in my nature either to sit on my laurels. Like that's part of the reason why I don't own a pair of fresh Pigeon Dunks. It's because I don't want to put this thing in a trophy case and just look at it every day and be, pat myself on the back and be like, that in 2005, Jeff, great job every day of my life. You know, like I kind of want to just forget about it and like move on, you know?
Yeah, and I think from the outside, things always look simple. And having an idea like, hey, let's do a t-shirt brand, that's quite easy. But doing this for 25 years, as you said, and having the guts and the ups and downs, and probably in 2008, 2009, retail, everything was really hard and things were not that easy. But sticking to it and just keep going, not a lot of people do that. Just as you say, for 25 years, running a business is really hard. Yeah. And fast forward till today, you're still doing Staple and you still have your kind of agency business. Now it's called Reed Art Department. Yep. But on the other hand, it's just, it's an accomplishment if you do something that long.
Yeah, yeah. And I've always been about that mentality of like, it's a marathon and not a sprint, you know? I've always been like thinking to myself, and when I was looking at other people in the industry, there's people that were way more creatively talented, way more artistically driven, way cooler, way richer, way better looking. Like I didn't have any category that like I could excel in. Like, you know, I wasn't the hot guy at the nightclub. I wasn't getting all the girls. I wasn't rich. I wasn't artistic. But I did know that the one thing that I did have was that I will outwork everyone. Like I will, you know, like when you're a kid and you try to hold your breath underwater, like that game, you know, I will hold my breath underwater longer than anybody. Like I will just bear with it and like bear the pain, you know, because I can't outperform you in any other way. I could just outgrind you. And so that was my one thing. And I think if I just, I thought to myself, if I just was like outwork people, then I can stay ahead because I just don't have the natural born talents that other people have. You know, like, you know, I'm not Futura. I'm not like, you know, Cause where like I could just make this amazing thing or like, you know, JR or something like that, like these other amazing artists. I don't come from a family of factory owners and like I could make a garment by calling my uncle. Like there's no hookups here, you know? So it's been really a grind and a struggle. But to your point, the beauty in what I've done is not necessarily a particular product or a particular shoe. I think the beauty of what I've done is in the legacy of the entire thing. It's the entire 25 year and counting thing that is awesome, you know, not like that one shoe or that one t-shirt.
But I think there's a second piece at least to outworking everyone that I experienced when being in touch with you. And I think that should be encouraging to everyone who's starting a business and doing business, that you can still be a nice person even when you're successful or if you run a business. And I think this is quite underestimated these days, that you don't have to be an asshole to do something and to be respected by a lot of people. So I experienced that when I had the chance to be in your office in 2008-09 for 2 days, and you were the first one who actually showed me an Uber and what this means in 2008-09. And
if I only bought some shares.
Yeah. And maybe this is kind of disrespecting, but it's, you're a nice person. And I think this is also so valuable. And if you're a nice person, that pays out in the long term, because people remember that you haven't treated them bad 10 years ago, or that you try to make money over them and that they mm-hmm. look bad or anything. I think this is also piece of your success as well.
Yeah, I think that goes along with reputation, right? Like, you know, there's a lot to be said for how you treat people. I've always been a firm believer in the same people you see going up the ladder are going to be the same people you see coming down the ladder. I've always experienced growing up a lot of like prejudice and just misjudgment, you know, and I never want to treat somebody that way, you know, no matter like, and you never know who you're talking to. Like, you could be talking to someone that you think is a complete bum, but he's actually the CEO of a $1 billion corporation and you just screwed yourself, you know? So you want everyone to give you your time and respect to speak and like address yourself. You should also give everyone that time, you know, to let them be themselves. I remember one time when I was young, I managed, this is even pre-Staple, this might be like 96 or something. I managed to schedule an interview with the Versace group to show some of my work and to do some freelance work for them. So I go to I have my portfolio ready. I try to dress like, in my mind, the best that I can dress. This is a Versace meeting. I go to the Versace headquarters in New York City. I have my portfolio case and everything. And I walk into the front lobby and the security guy says, hey, stop. Service entrance is in the back. He wants me to use the entrance. He probably thought I was like delivering food or something, like because I'm Chinese. Like, he's like, deliveries are in the back. And I'm like, yo, I'm here to meet Versace. Like, I'm not here to make a delivery, you know? And he made me go through the back. And I remember when I exited out the front, I didn't get mad at him. And it was a real pivotal point because I could have been like, yo, fuck you, man. You know, do you know who I am? You know? But like, I'm like, no, you're just doing your job to the best of your ability. The prejudice that you're putting on me is actually a reflection of yourself more so than it is of me. And so I was just like, have a good day, bro. You know, bro, have a nice one. And I walked out the front door and he was like, wait, why didn't he walk out the back entrance? You know? And so like that always, like, you never know who you're talking to. Don't do that to people because that could really screw you over, you know? So just give everyone respect, like from a janitor to a CEO, I talk to everyone the same.
Jeff, we could spend another hour. Maybe just one last question at least.
Yeah, sure.
So many things have happened in the last 12 months around COVID, et cetera, and we don't want to go into this, but what kind of chances do you see coming up in the future? So retail has totally changed. Everything is moving toward online, et cetera. But are there particular things that you think, this is what I'm excited about and this is what I want to get going and this is what's going to change for the positive?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's funny that we talked about what happened during 9/11 and how that really affected my business in a really monumental way. You know, one could argue, I've never thought about this before. I've never even observed this before until right now. One could argue that if it wasn't for 9/11, the pigeon dunk may never have happened. That's a distinct possibility, you know?
Yes.
Like, because all these things, like ReadSpace had to happen. I wouldn't have gone to ReadSpace if it wasn't for 9/11, you know? So like, I think we're now in a similarly, you know, obviously much worse, but similar sort of like global catastrophic moment that has affected everyone. And some people will look at it as an opportunity to wave the white flag, as they say, and be like, oh, life is too hard. I give up. It's just too hard, you know? And some will see the opportunity as like, no, there's still a lot of great things that could happen out of this. And I want to be able to tap into that. And that's what we've been doing. We've never been busier. We've never been more successful in these COVID years. Now, my prediction coming out of this is that what this did do was it reset our values and it hit a big reset button in terms of our appreciation for each other as people in real life situations, like just shaking the hand of someone, giving a hug to someone, interacting with someone in real life, whether it's at a store or a concert or a restaurant. The value of these things will be increased dramatically, and I think they will stay there. I don't think it's gonna, like, we're gonna come back and then we're gonna lose sight of it very quickly, because the one thing about this particular virus is that we all know that it can happen again and it can mutate. So we're now prepared for the fact that another COVID-type virus can infect the Earth. And so we have to be very precious about the time that we have with each other. I think that very innate value will stay with us. And similar to how now, this is not the greatest of analogies, but you know how like there's all these electric cars and self-driving cars and Teslas, but there's this group that understands why you want a 6-speed manual transmission BMW. There's still that group. There's that group that understands why you want to invest in a 12-inch vinyl wax record, right? And these, like, vinyl right now is outselling CDs. It's like they've never had more sales in vinyl records. So I think in real life experiences, restaurants, festivals, even just family gatherings now are going to be so amped up in terms of value that it's going to open up a whole market of, like, you know, just things that I can't even think of. But I just think that, like, these things are just going to be, like, really cherished and people are going to really value them, you know. And I can't wait to see what that does for humanity, that we're going to remember what it was like during COVID and how important it is that we don't want to lose sight of the fact that being together in person is so important. You know, I don't think Zoom's going away. I just think that when you have an in-person meeting now, you're going to cherish it a lot more and put a lot more time, effort, and value into it.
Yeah, and you choose more wisely. Do I really go there? Do I spend all this time? And maybe I do it once a year or twice a year to spend some good quality time with a business partner. And then the rest of the year, we can be in Zoom calls instead of just being on AirPods forever and all the time.
Yeah. And more importantly, you know, it's not just about being on Zoom calls. It's the aftermath and the ripple effect of that, right? So if instead of me flying to, you know, Tokyo to have this meeting and spending a week, I will now make that a Zoom call. And those 6.5 days that I've saved, I'm going to spend that with my children. Like, exactly. That's the shift. It's not just about, like, let me save this hour, you know, or something like that. It's values. And quite frankly, any business that, let's say, today might be sacrificed, for example, maybe like fashion trade shows might not come back, like, because we've been able to figure out how to do business without them. Maybe they were on the way out anyway.
And yeah, maybe I think this, so as well.
Yeah, and this just accelerated everything and made everyone see it in reality, you know? So any business that is gone away because of this, maybe they were on their way out.
Yeah, I think so as well. And this is the only catastrophe that we as a global community have experienced. So 9/11, yeah, we saw that in Europe on television. And yes, we were somehow impacted. And I don't know, stock markets were altered for 2-3 days. And yes, oh, we can't travel to New York for the next few weeks and months because there has been this terrorist attack.
Yeah.
And yes, they're going to Iraq and do something there, but the rest of the world was not that much impacted,
right?
And everything kind of went as it was before. But now you can talk to any person in the world, everyone knows what COVID is, and every single person had some kind of an impact. And I think also that a few things will come out of it that we might even like looking back.
I know.
Even if you're not aware of those today.
I agree. Yeah, it's the only thing that affected all of us. Notice, do you remember before COVID, there was all this talk about, like, every week in the news was ISIS and, you know, Al-Qaeda and, like, North versus South Korea and all this stuff. Have you noticed since COVID, like, there's been almost no talk of these, like, internal political beefs? It's because we're all fighting the same thing. It's almost like everyone was like, yes, I hate Blacks, I hate Jews, I hate gays, I hate whatever, you know, Palestine. But right now, we all have one enemy. So let's all put down our gun for 1 second and let's all fight this common enemy, you know. And that's like the silver lining of all of this is like, oh, wow, we're all at the end of the day human. We all bleed and we all can die. And here's a thing that is affecting all of us. So in that way, I love that it hit that reset button for all of us, that like there's more important things than like your individual values and your individual beliefs. You are, at the end of the day, a carbon-based life form on planet Earth. Don't forget that.
Yeah, and I hope it stays like that and not that once everything is back to normal that, okay, we're bored, now let's fight each other again.
Yeah, I guarantee you that is what will happen, though.
Hopefully not. People should spend their energy and spend it with their families or going to restaurants and party hard or do whatever. So
yeah,
we will, of course. And Jeff, thanks so much for your time. We could spend another 2 hours talking about all that. So thanks. I really appreciate taking your time. And it was really interesting to get some more insights on a few pieces that I didn't know yet.
You're welcome.
Thanks a lot.
Great chatting.